Tonight on Arena. All aboard, Emma Donoghue is on the Paris Express and we preview Iggy Pop's visit to Dublin. You can text us on 51551 or tweet at RT Arena or watch live on rte.ie/arena. As ever, Thursday is when we look forward to the new stock of films in our cinemas. What awaits us? Well, the end of the world as we know it. De Niro versus De Niro and a woke princess in distress. First up, we have Flo, an animated movie about a motley group of animals surviving a global flood. Latvian director Jin Zibelodis recently took home the Best Animated Film Oscar for this ambitious and unique adventure. Film two is Alto Heights, a mafia thriller which stars Robert De Niro and Robert De Niro in the two main roles. Directed by Barry Levinson, has teamed up again with De Niro in this tale of 1950s New York mobsters. And finally, Walt Disney's Pictures reimagines Snow White for 2025. Mark Webb directs this new live-action version which stars Rachel Zegler as Snow White, while Wonder Woman herself, Gal Gadot, is the evil queen. Tara Brady and Declan Burke have been to the movies for us and they join me now. Declan, we begin with Flo, which begins with an abandoned cat, which turns into then a group of animals travelling across a world devastated by floods. Can you describe the world of Flood?
Yeah, well, I you know, have it at the idea that any cat will be abandoned. It's usually that the cat would abandon the humans, but you're right, it's a non-human world. We meet this the cat beautifully, simply kind of hand-drawn animation, and it seems to be moving through an overgrown kind of world. It looks like a world that's been rewilded and so forth. We meet lots of kind of cat sculptures. There's obviously a human there that has loved this cat, but we don't see any human presence. And there's a
yes, and the cat is trying to survive on his own, isn't he? He's no one to give him his cat food.
And a beautifully sleek cat. But anyway, what it ends up doing is it interrupts a pack of dogs who are kind of clumsily fishing and so forth, and they manage to get a fish out of the river. The cat steals the fish and it runs away. And we've established a kind of a narrative here that it's, you know, species who are in competition and so forth, but in what appears to be a non-human world, or at least a world in which the humans have disappeared.
So, Tara, the animals don't speak. They are presented to us as animals. Mm-hmm. So can we still empathise with them without they having human characteristics, for example?
Oh yeah, no, I mean, very much. And I think one of the great things that the director, Zilbalobas, does is that he makes the animals. And it's a thing that we've seen in, like, Studio Ghibli is always very careful to, they send their animators down to zoos and things to draw animals and to see how animals really move. And it's so much more effective and soulful in a way than looking at anthropomorphized animals doing, like, you know, a jig or whatever it is that they're doing on screen, because it gives them a kind of dignity. But it also, like, even little details which I think are like absolutely exquisite, like the sound that, like, they've gone around different wildlife enclosures and taped different animals now, and most of the animals play themselves, but I think they've got a camel to stand in for the capybara, because capybaras make a very, very strange sound. But that adds this kind of lovely texture to it that you can tell it's made by someone who loves animals.
And they end up on a boat.
Yes.
And what kind of world are they floating through?
It's some kind of post-apocalyptic landscape. We get no explanation about that. We just kind of roll with it. And really, it's about them bonding, despite being, you know, different species and very, very different characters. It's about them having to work together across this landscape. And it is left completely mysterious. But that's what makes it really magical, and that's what makes it, like, you're completely transported while watching it.
You would presume, Declan, that it is in some way about climate change and that the humans are no longer on this planet because maybe of something they've done.
It's very clearly about climate change. The animals are forced to take to this boat, dare we call it an ark, because it's floodwaters that are rising and rising and rising. And there's actually some exquisitely kind of agonizing scenes as the cat tiptoes higher and higher on these statues. And you know, we think it's going to drown and so forth. But the climate crisis, that's straight in your face. That's the kind of reason for making the film, I suppose. But really the most important theme, I think, as Tara alludes to, is the idea that these different species who are initially suspicious of one another and fearful, they're kind of prey to one another in one shape or another, but they have to learn to cooperate and they have to learn to clumsily learn to navigate this boat. And again, as Tara says, this idea that they're not anthropomorphized, they have to learn on their own terms, their own animal terms, how do you steer a boat, and they figure it out and so forth. But that idea of cooperation in these extreme circumstances, I think that's the most important aspect of the film.
I think, Harry, you said that Jens Zabolodis, the director, that this mirrors his own development, this use of going from one person or one thing, the cat, and then having to work with all the other animals. This reflects his own type of work.
Well, Ginsmead is a very remarkable talent. He's completely self-taught because he couldn't, because growing up in Latvia, he couldn't find an animation course. So he made his first feature entirely in his bedroom over 4 years, Away, which was released in 2019, and which is also incredible, and also wordless, which is not easy to do, to make a piece of cinema that's entirely wordless. So this one, he was working with a very small team from France and Belgium. I mean, the Oscar win is really significant because this film was, even with that small team, which he had to learn to work with and come out of his bedroom, this cost $3.5 million, and it was up against, in the Oscar category, Inside Out 2, which was made for $200 million, and it was up against The Wild Robot, which was made for $100 million. And not only is that significant, but then you're not factoring in the fact that those kind of movies have big studios behind them and would have had a huge Oscar campaign that would have been another few million on top of that, you know, with ads in trades, newspapers and things like that. Like, this has just come up, you know, entirely on its own merits, and it's just this lovely thing, and it has that feel that it was that small people who loved it worked on it, like a small team that loved it worked on it.
I think eerie was a word you said to describe it, Declan.
I said, yeah, that was my sense, you know, from very early on. I mean, really the only sense we get of human habitation, the cat lives in an abandoned house. We come across these crumbling ruins or temples. We're not entirely sure what they are. But yeah, there is a certain eeriness because there is no human presence, and also because they don't have that anthropomorphic quality, the animals themselves. So it felt quite strange to me, but in a very enjoyable way, I have to say. And once I realised after 10 minutes, this is the way he's taken the story, I was very, very happy to lean into that.
OK, stars out of 5 from you, Declan.
Yeah, I think it's beautifully drawn, very subtly told. And a must see, obviously, for cat people. So 4 out of 5 for me.
Are you a cat person, Tara?
I'm a cat and a dog person. I love the lab too. So I'll go the full 5.
The full 5. Oh, excellent! That's a 5 and a 4 out of 5 for Flow. So Tara, we're on to Alto Nights now. This gives us 2 Robert De Niros for the price of 1. Could you set this up? It's a gangster story,
yes.
And it's set in the 1950s.
So it's a true life gangster story. And if you don't know it's true life, you will recognize that it is by the fact that there's this barrage of narration from the moment you sit down, and 40 minutes in we're still getting all this kind of explanations. We get straight to camera narration, we get voiceover, we get bits of archive footage, we get the camera pointed at news stories, radio stories and TV stories in order to keep explaining what's going on and explaining the people we're looking at. And then we have Robert De Niro under a lot of prosthetics playing dual roles as Frank Costello and Vito Genovese, who are 2 Italian-American associates, I suppose we could call them, and they're battling for control of the Luciano crime syndicates in the 1950s in New York. So the way the film sets it up is it's a bit of a dubious distinction. I think most people will agree that Costello is the gentleman mobster. You know, he runs, you know, sort of guns and liquor and rackets and clubs and all that, and then the Vito is the kind of more hot-headed one, and he's into he wants to get into the drug trade. So it kind of sets up that distinction, which is something that you very often find in mob films.
And they're both from poverty-stricken background in Italy.
Well, no. they're both New Yorkers, so that's really this it's completely focused on this kind of New York story. Vito becomes this kind of king abroad because he's avoiding doing time in America, and he ends up in Italy during World War II. And then when he comes back, there's this huge battle for control of territory in New York because he wants a bigger piece of the pie.
So of course there has to be a scene where both De Niro's meet each other. And here we have him in the dual role in a scene with himself as mob boss Vito and Frank Costello.
You're going down a very dangerous road. You know that. And we ain't been down dangerous roads before. All of a sudden we can't go down dangerous roads.
This is
before.
A road that I'm not going down because you're going to take us all down. This is not the way. You know, it's just a matter of time you're going to get pinched.
But don't forget, you're a racketeer. You're a gangster. Come on. All of a sudden, you want to be half in, half out, half a racketeer. You can't have it both ways. You're either in or you're out. And whether you're half in or half out, that don't mean you ain't going to get caught the same way I could get caught or I could go down. It's the same thing. Come on, don't be naive. We don't control this. Somebody else does it.
This is a death sentence. It's a big, big mistake.
Look, you do what you want. You want to be a diplomat, that's your business. Me? I'm a gangster. I'm a racketeer. That's it. That's it. That's the life.
So, Declan, they don't sound that different. Do they look very different? Is there confusion?
There is no visual confusion. There's quite a bit of prosthetics involved with the character of Vito Genovese. So, yeah, you're never in any doubt as to which is which. And there's very much the idea of one is yin and yang, and as Tara says, that tired old trope of, you know, the good mobster versus the vicious, which is a whole pile of nonsense, unfortunately. I think that De Niro does relatively well given the circumstances. I'm not sure why they had to cast two De Niros, but in the circumstances, I think he does relatively well. Look, he's been playing this part or a variation on it for the best part of 50 years, so he's completely comfortable in it.
And are there prosthetics to make them look different?
Yeah, I think Vito has a slightly sharper, more bulbous nose, and it's so that the Frank Costello character is portrayed as being more comfortable and more relaxed in himself because he is, you know, he's a charitable type and he's a patron of all these wonderful organisations, whereas the character of Vito is portrayed as much more narrow and insular, and he is paranoid and he's vicious and so forth. So there's no issue visually with the discrimination between them. My issue, in similar to Tara, is that this idea of, you know, the two boys who grew up in the hardscrabble streets of New York and experienced poverty, as you suggested, and they go their different paths. Their paths were not that different in real life. And I think, to a large extent, it feels as if there is a distinction made by Barry Levinson and Nicholas Pileggi, who wrote Goodfellas and has been writing this kind of story, you know, for the best part of 30 or 40 years. They're trying to state that there's more of a difference between these two characters than there actually was in real life.
All right. So do you think there's anything new in this from the gangster genre, given all the developments that there has been, even since Goodfellas, because we've had The Sopranos, we've had so many fantastic views of the gangster life?
No, I mean, even if this had come out right after Goodfellas, it would have felt like a kind of a tired old story. It doesn't. There are, like, you know, Pileggi can write a really good scene. And there's a couple of really nice, very post-Soprano scenes. There's a lovely heated exchange when they're all driving along the road, and there's a fight about where the Mormons were from in the States. And there's a couple of good, like, very, very, you know, well-written scenes like that. But the film itself doesn't really hold together. Like, structurally, it's an absolute mess. You end up with, like, a lot of repetition. And for all the explanation, like I was saying to you, the way it's stacked up at the beginning, you're sort of sitting there for 40 minutes and waiting for the film to start. Well, when like, are people going to just stop explaining what's going on here and, like, actually get into a scene, or because that would or a story? So that's a problem. I just found the De Niro casting completely gimmicky as well. I don't think there's anything new to say here, and I don't think it says it in a particularly interesting way.
What about supporting cast, Declan? Deborah Messing plays one of their, I think it's
Bobby Costello.
Costello's wife. And then Catherine Narducci plays the other wife.
She plays, Vito's partner at one stage in his career. I mean, we can say they co-star. They're not on screen enough, really, to make any kind of worthwhile impression, which is a pity, because I think both Deborah Messing and Catherine Narducci, and particularly Catherine Narducci, she's a force of nature when she's on screen, and suddenly there's a whole different dynamic in the story. It's not just about De Niro on De Niro. So I personally could have done a lot more with both of those. Deborah Messing, maybe a little less so, but she has a kind of a controlling... not a controlling in a negative sense, but she has she can exert a little control on the character of Frank Costello. Not enough of them, basically, is what I'm trying to say.
Okay, stars out of five from you, Tara, for Alto Nights.
It's two, I'm afraid.
Okay, Declan?
Yeah, I'm going to give two stars for each De Niro.
Would that be four out of five?
It is a four out of five. It is a tired, it's a retread of the classic mobster shows, but it's De Niro being kind of peak, not quite peak De Niro, but it's doing classic De Niro.
With two very distinctive characters.
Yeah, and I think if you're a De Niro fan, I think you will get bang for your buck.
Which you obviously are, Tara.
Which I am. Mm-hmm.
Less so. Okay, our final film tonight sees Disney returning to one of the stories that made the studio famous, Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. It was originally released in 1937, and here we have a new version simply called Snow White. Would it be fair to say the film has attracted lots of attention, Declan?
Well, obviously it has, and not necessarily for the right reasons. There's been huge issues about, so Rachel Zegler, for example, being cast as Snow White when she's Colombian, for example, which is a whole load of nonsense as far as I'm concerned. It's been criticised for being too woke, because the Seven Dwarfs can no longer be called dwarfs, which is fair enough if that's what people don't want to be called. I have no issue with that. But there's been a lot of negativity in advance of this, and the fact that Gal Gadot and Rachel Zegler have both made fairly high-profile pronouncements on the war in Gaza hasn't helped it at this point so far. In terms of the story itself, if we can concentrate on the film, they try and remake a classic animated film in 2025 when the elements that worked in 1937 simply don't work anymore. And I say that as someone who's a big fan of the Disney animated movies, and particularly the princess movies, because I have a young daughter and she came through that whole arc and I was totally on board with most of it. You can make a live action remake of a Disney animated classic well, as was the case with Beauty and the Beast, or you can make an absolute dog's dinner of it, as was the case with Pinocchio. This isn't quite as bad as Pinocchio, but it's nowhere as good as Beauty and the Beast.
Tara?
Yeah, this is a mess. So we end up with this Snow White who's living in a kingdom, and it's a monarchy, but it also seems to be some kind of communist monarchy where the royals go and bake apple pies, which just makes you think of, like, you know, something Marie Antoinette didn't say, let them eat pie. But none of it adds up, and then it becomes a little bit Robin Hood, and then they're having some kind of revolution, and the revolution is to give the monarchy back to the monarch, but also to the people. And so politically, it's a complete mess. It's a complete jumble. But the biggest problem for me, and it's a huge problem visually, is the decision to have, you've got a live action cast, and then the dwarf characters are cartoons. So they're given the same treatment as, like, the cutesy woodland critters. And whoever thought that was a good idea, or that it was going to play well on screen, it takes you out of the movie, and it's also incredibly offensive. It just doesn't work at all.
I think at the centre of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs, or Snow White in this case, is that aggression between the new queen and the princess. How does that work between the evil stepmother Snow White?
It's set up in classic fashion. Gal Gadot plays the evil stepmother who has usurped Snow White's father's throne. And of course, she has the magic mirror, and it's mirror on the wall, and who's the fairest of them all. And eventually the mirror announces that Snow White is fairer than the beautiful queen. And that's when Snow White has to go. And that's all pretty standard stuff. And, you know, they do that quite well, except The Eva Queen's a plum role. I mean, how can you not play that well? All you have to do is ham it up, chew the scenery.
Yes, overdo it, yeah.
And I thought Gal Gadot was incredibly flat the whole way through this film. I couldn't believe in her. I mean, I know it's a fairy tale, but I simply couldn't believe in the character.
Tara, do you agree?
Oh yeah, no. I think it's about. I think almost all of the characters around Snow, and the sad thing is that like Rachel Zegler has been attacked repeatedly in the run up to this film, and she's the best thing in the movie by far. But like everyone else is little. I mean, and it's not always the actors' faults. I think like the love interest, who's no longer a prince, but is the kind of Robin Wood character, a Robin Hood character, Jonathan, played by Andrew Burnup. Like he's so dull. I mean, it's such a dull role, and like the guy's singing his heart out, and for what?
Okay, this doesn't sound good. So stars from you, Declan, for Snow White.
Yeah, as Tara says, Rachel Zegler is very good, and on the strength of that, I'm going to give this 3 out of 5.
And from you, Tara?
Oh, I can't go beyond 2. I'm afraid
2. Okay, well, my thanks to Tara Brady and Declan Burke. Flo, Alto Nights and Snow White all go on general release in cinemas from tomorrow. Emma Donoghue has taken us to all manner of places and historical eras in her novels, plays and screenplays, from early works like Slammerkin to Room and more recently The Pull of the Stars. Her new novel, The Paris Express, takes us to 1895 and an actual 8-hour train journey from the coast of Normandy to the French capital, which ended in a crash in Montparnasse. The novel introduces the reader to a range of characters on board as the train hurtles to its destination and its place in the history books. One of the passengers is John Millington Synge, no less. I'm delighted to be joined by Emma Donoghue and to talk about her new book, The Paris Express. Emma, you are so welcome back on Arena.
Thank you, thank you. You find me in Washington, D.C. right now on a beautiful spring lunchtime.
Oh, you have abandoned Canada, I'm sure, to do some promotion. So congratulations on the Paris Express, Emma. Would you describe the picture that I think drew you first of all and started you on the journey to create this novel, The Paris Express?
Absolutely. When I knew I was going to Paris for a year, I found us a flat in Montparnasse. And then I thought I'd Google the area. And the first thing I saw was this extraordinary image of a steam train barreling out the upper floor of a train station and plunging vertically. It's the most surreal image of, modernity and speed and progress all gone horribly awry. So that photo, in fact, it was a whole cluster of photos that a number of different photographers took when they rushed to the scene of the accident, that directly and immediately inspired the novel.
Yes, and this is an iconic picture in France. I mean, students have it on their walls, but we may not be so knowledgeable about it because we're not French.
Oh, I think it was an American dorm room poster. It's gone worldwide. It still turns up as a meme on the internet with, little rude slogans about how your day can suddenly go very pear-shaped. But to me, it was a wonderful accident to write about because it all happened because of speed. They were running 10 minutes late that day because one customer, a rather entitled member of parliament, had asked for the train to be stopped at an unscheduled spot so that his private carriage could be put on. And this caused a 10-minute delay, which, coming from Ireland, I would have thought was no bother at all. But in France in 1895, it was unacceptable. So then the driver felt he had to make up the time, so they barreled into Paris.
So the structure of this book is like All Aboard. You take us from Granville, which is in the Normandy coast, leaving at 8:30, and you have us on a journey of 8 hours until it arrives in Paris. And what you decided to do was to populate the train with characters who you know, real characters who were on the train, and then interesting characters you found to be alive, making art, being engineers, doing interesting things in Belle Epoque, France.
I just had no need to make anyone up because 1895, France was so littered with interesting people. The city was a hub for science, for sort of personal liberation, you know, all sorts of troublemakers and rebels and leaders of industry turned up there. So I was honestly so spoiled for choice with such an amazing diversity of people, not just in wealth, but in terms of nationality, for instance. We have a model of Gauguin's from Indonesia. We have young John Singh, very much a drifter student, not knowing he was going to be turning out to be a brilliant playwright. We have American painters, North African coffee sellers with giant tanks of coffee on their backs, Cambodian students. I mean, it was just the most dazzlingly multicultural environment. So I felt I should just go ahead and invite these people onto my train.
Now, it's very easy for me to say it must have been an easy structure to put together when it's in the hands of somebody as brilliant a writer as you. But you have the time code, and you also have this wonderful, almost class system in terms of a train. So describe the structure you have put on the Paris Express, Emma.
Sure, you're right. It's a very, you know, obvious choice of structure in that I wanted to make the novel be like a train. I thought it would be a waste to take this dramatic material and then write a baggy book about it. So I made the novel as lean and mean and streamlined as I possibly could. And the rhythm of the long runs between stations and then the brief frantic pauses at stations, that was the kind of guiding principle of my novel. It made it a bit like Morse code, you know, like drive, drive, and then out your pop and look for a toilet as fast as possible. But it was quite fiddly, I have to say, because I had all these different elements and I needed to constantly change little things. I'd say like, okay, if she moves into that carriage, then the guard wouldn't have a reason to check her ticket until the next time. So I felt like a rather harried station employee, you know, trying to round up all my passengers and check their paperwork.
Yeah, which all adds to the propulsion of the novel, because you feel that you're moving headlong towards Montparnasse station all the time. If we could go back to then the class system, which even though it was the Belle Epoque in France, a change was on the agenda. There was so many interesting developments in architecture, in engineering, and in art, obviously. But the class system was very much there and writ large, really, in the carriages of the train.
Absolutely. For instance, the first class carriages were not only all opulent red velvet, they were tucked in the middle of the train so that if the train suffered some horrific collision at either end, they'd be safe in the middle of the sandwich. And there's a moment when one of my main characters, a young woman called Madeleine Pelletier, who's a furious, bitter, raging member of the working class, you know, she says that the train is an image of the long...
I think Emma's line has...
You're
back, Emma. Just say that again. What did you say Madeleine Pelletier said about the train?
She said that a train was an image of the long con of life. You know, it was a little microcosm of the unfairness of society. And in particular... She would say that the fact that they were, you know, charging the rich people much more money but giving them much more comfort and privacy was just an epitome of how society was structured. So for my purposes, the novel couldn't have been better as a way of summing up, the entire range of society in one compact situation.
And in fact, it was the needs of one of the characters on board the train that actually added to it not making its time to Montparnasse.
The whim of a rich man, basically. Yeah. So that the train that day happened to have three members of parliament on it. And one of them thought, it'll be more convenient if the train stops near my country house so I can put my wife's invalid carriage on. And so then the crew of the train felt under enormous pressure to make up that time because their pay absolutely depended on punctuality. And this sort of unwritten message to them from the company, the railway company, was, look, it's not officially allowed to speed, but we'll pay you a lot more if you can get everyone to Paris on time. So the convenience of the rich basically brought on this terrible accident.
Could we get back to Mado or Madeline, as you talked about? She's such an interesting character. First of all, we see her and how she dresses. And then we find out she's an anarchist. And she's also idolizes a young man called Emile Henry. And he is, a martyred anarchist. What was it about that time that fed anarchy so much? Was it a way that individuals felt that they could change society by a violent act?
Yes, it's funny. I think this novel will remind a lot of people of modern life today, in that you're always slightly aware of the danger of some random terrorist attack. But in the case of the 1890s, the danger was coming from the extreme left, anarchism, yes. And I suppose one thing I found so interesting to write about in terms of anarchism was that they were so idealistic and meant really well. You know, I mean, they absolutely wanted to improve the lives of the poor and bring social justice and care about women and care about the workers, but their methods were not guaranteed to actually improve anything in the short term. So to write about Madeleine Pelletier, you know, thinking of exploding this entire train, and by the way, the reason I put that storyline in is that journalists of the day, they asked several people in Paris, what did you think when you heard the terrible sound? And they all said, oh, an anarchist bomb, obviously. So I thought to myself, what if there had been one? And I was so intrigued by the idea of a bomber, not as some cold-blooded killer, but as an absolute idealist, you know, someone almost like the young girl in my novel, The Wonder, who, you know, means really, really well, but her ideals have taken on a warped form.
Yes, by starving herself, yes.
Exactly.
Then we have the two drivers of there's Guillaume and Victor, and they are bonded together in their work at driving the train, but they're also bonded in another way, romantically.
You know, I got this idea from a Zola novel, La Bête Humaine, The Human Beast. Zola, in his famous novel of the trains, he drops this heavy hint where he says, and by the way, he researched it by riding around France with these drivers. He says that the company, the railway company, would put the driver and the stoker, the one who fed the coal into the furnace, would put them in the boarding house with their beds close together every second night. And I suddenly thought, how extraordinary that extreme closeness between these men was part of what they were being paid for in their job. Because the company found that if the two of them worked as closely as acrobats together, that they and their train, they had the same train every day, would just be able to maximize efficiency. So, you know, almost emotional labor, you could call it. So I thought, you know, what if this pair were in fact much closer than they were to their wives?
So into these different the train carriages, you sometimes stuff and sometimes people have a lot more room. But you have that wonderful North African coffee. He's North African, is he? Sorry, coffee seller.
Yes, a sort of a human coffee pot. Yeah.
Yes, and he wears this apparatus that you must surely have seen somewhere, or is that out of your imagination?
No, I found it in a painting. You know, I spent that whole year of 2022 to 2023 in Paris, and in the historical museum there, I saw this painting with this man wearing this massive tank rearing above his head, full of hot coffee and, you know, unable to sit down. And I thought, what a perfect image of, you know, someone having to turn themselves into an object to serve the convenience of travellers, you know, and like the way we're all rushing off for our cup of, for our latte before we get on a train today. And so there were so many contemporary parallels. I mean, I never go looking for them when I write historical fiction, but they just leap out at me. You know, there are so many things in the past that rhyme with things today. And I absolutely love the way historical fiction lets you look at things from a different angle and lets you realise that in many ways we're still moving around the world in very 19th century structures. You know, we're using cars with an internal combustion engine just like in the 1890s. We're riding on trains. A lot of us are still in, you know, Victorian brick houses. So, you know, the past is not past.
Yes, and then that whole idea of transportation, as well as you populate the carriages with artists and the coffee seller and wonderful an artist model, writers like Millington Synge, you also have conversations or arguments between people who are saying, oh, the steam train is dead. We must look at new modern ways of transportation. And again, you do this through the characters you put on in the same carriage.
Absolutely. And not just transport, but other new technologies of speed. For instance, one scientist on the train, Marcel de Heredia, she was the daughter of Paris had a black mare, would you believe, from Cuba, and she was his daughter. So there's this young mixed race scientist, a student of Marie Curie's, and she's got her portable typewriter on the train. And there's another young woman on the train with a movie camera, because she's Alice Guy, who was the secretary for a man called Gaumont, a name you'll now know from film studios. And she was basically one of the inventors of the motion picture, in that she was the first one to say, let's do little fictional films instead of just, you know, documentary. So all these new dazzling technologies, and so many of the characters are enamored of them. But the story of the crashing train also reminds us that these technologies can have a terrible cost that we often don't think of when we're plunging on in our enthusiasm. And, you know, I feel the same way about something like AI today. You know, sometimes we can be so bedazzled by the speed of progress that we don't think about what it's costing.
I have to ask you, like, this is a book about political turbulence. How are you as a Canadian resident feeling about Donald Trump's claiming Canada as the 51st state?
Oh, I'm extremely threatened and nervous and appalled. Yeah, yeah. To feel that you're a citizen of a sovereign nation, and that the big nation next door is cracking jokes that may not be jokes about wanting to take you over. It raises my hackles. Yeah. So it's funny. I when I was writing this novel, even I wouldn't have thought it was going to feel so directly relevant to the political situation as it is today. And, you know, even a word like diversity, which to me is an obvious good, both socially and in terms of making a better novel, it suddenly in the American context seems, you know, a highly politicized term and something you have to actually make a case for.
Well, my thanks, Emma Donoghue, for talking to us again on Arena. Congratulations on the Paris Express.
Thank you so much. It's always a pleasure.
And published by Picador. Often hailed as the godfather of punk, Iggy Pop will play the Meadows at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham on Saturday, June the 7th. Born James Newell Ostenberg Jr. in 1947, Iggy's career spanned five decades. He first achieved fame as the frontman of the band The Stooges, and later as a successful solo artist whose stage persona is marked by his provocative antics and raw musical style. He has made an indelible mark on the evolution of rock music from his early days in Michigan and his groundbreaking collaboration with David Bowie. Here's a clip of the young Iggy back in 1977 on a US talk show discussing what punk rock is.
Punk rock is a word used by dilettantes. Okay. and heartless manipulators about music that takes up the energies and the bodies and the hearts and the souls and the time and the minds of young men who give what they have to it and give everything they have to it. And it's a term that's based on contempt. It's a term that's based in fashion, style, elitism, Satanism, and everything that's rotten about rock and roll.
So that was Iggy Pop speaking in 1977, and I'm joined now in studio by Paul McLoon to discuss Iggy Pop's legacy. Are you excited about him coming?
Oh God, yeah, always excited about seeing Iggy. I've been lucky enough to see him many times, actually. I was thinking about this on the way over. I've actually seen him 7 or 8 times over the years, and especially with the Stooges, when he reformed the Stooges in the early part of the noughties for a few years, until basically most of them actually died, very sadly. But
always exciting.
It was just brilliant. I mean, particularly at the Electric Picnic in 2007, I believe the year was. It was just an astonishing show. Still to this day, I get shivers thinking about how brilliant that performance was. He's just incredible. So it'll be interesting to see what that energy level is like now. The last time I saw him was 9 years ago in London. He was a mere whippersnapper of, you know, what, 68 then? He's 77 now. So we'll see what the energy level is still like. I mean, he's superhuman, but he's not immune completely to age. So it'll be interesting to see what he can pull out of the bag. But I'd be excited, yeah.
So we'll rewind, Paul, and the Michigan boy called Jim Ostenberg Jr. Yeah. With a passion for jazz. How did that boy turn into this rebellious punk rocker?
Well, he was a very clean-cut kid, you know, decent family, decent parents, no drama with the family. They really actually nurtured him and looked after him. He was a drummer originally. They gave up their bedroom so he could put his drum kit in it, by all accounts. So there's no kind of delinquency in his youth. It really happened, I think, when he became obsessed with jazz, yes, and also the blues. I think as a young, very young man, he sort of dropped out of college. He was a college kid, very bright kid, very bright man, as you can tell from that clip, very articulate and intelligent man, very well read in his private life. So there's two aspects to there's Jim, he is Jim to his friends, and then there's Iggy. And I think Iggy really is a kind of a monster from the id, for want of a better cliche. You know, he just becomes this other creature on stage. And I think that all started with a passion for rock and roll and for blues and for jazz and for music and a desire to express himself, and ignited, like a lot of young artists, by guys that just got there before him. In his case, I think a big influence you could point to would be Jim Morrison from The Doors.
Right, that kind of outrageous stage presence and...
The idea of being confrontational with one's sort of theatricality and kind of pushing rock into an unsafe kind of area, and that slightly dangerous, well, not slightly, quite dangerous sort of energy and riotous kind of atmosphere that fosters. I think that made a huge impression on Iggy. And I think he kind of looked at it, realised his own sort of deeply hidden but genuinely present sort of desire to be very outrageous and to be kind of, I guess, to an extent, transgressive. And he saw in Jim Morrison a certain license to do that. And if anything, he went much, much further with it than Jim ever dreamt of.
We'll get to that in a second. But the formation of the Stooges was a turning point in his career. Is that fair to say?
Oh, absolutely. I think he was messing around with blues bands and college bands. As I say, he was a drummer originally. And at one point in a band called the Iguanas, he then joined another band, and that band gave him the nickname Iggy because he came from the Iguanas. So the Iggy thing was there at an early stage. But I think really hooking up with the Ashton brothers, who were the core of the Stooges. A guy called Dave Alexander was the bass player as well, but the Ashton brothers on guitar and drums. And I think they were genuinely delinquent kind of kids, but they could play like demons, and they could play in a very raw and kind of untutored but powerful way. And I think that just lit a fuse in Iggy Pop, the performer. And of course, like all the best bands, all these different aspects of it just came together, and the sum was much, much greater than the parts. But he was always the main kind of focus, obviously.
Okay, so we listen to I Want to Be Your Dog from the Stooges. I Want to Be Your Dog there from Iggy Pop and the Stooges, and I'm here with Paul McLoone. Paul, he met David Bowie in the early 70s. That was New York. We think of them in Berlin, but they met in New York.
Yes, they did indeed. And at that point, the Stooges had kind of collapsed, having released two albums, which are now rightly regarded as complete classics and cornerstones of punk rock and a lot of other stuff that came in their wake. Rather like the Velvet Underground, discovered sort of when their time at had passed really in terms of the release of the actual albums, but became very, very important records and more important to this day to young bands particularly who want to do stuff with drums and guitars. But that had ended with no success, and Iggy, unfortunately, like a couple of his bandmates, had a pretty serious drug habit by this stage, which had contributed to the collapse of the band. So he
pitched, and was that a heroin habit?
Yes, a heroin habit in Iggy's case. Yeah, so he pitches up in New York and somehow ends up in a notorious club called Max's Kansas City, where the Warhol crowd and guys like Lou Reed would hang out. Lou Reed from the Velvet Underground, of course, of whom Iggy was a fan. In fact, John Cale, the track we just heard, John Cale from that band, the Velvet Underground, produced the first Stooges album. So he would have been naturally, I think, kind of found himself attracted to that sort of stratum of life in New York, if you like. And of course, that's exactly where Bowie was trying to make his mark as well, trying to kind of break into that
Warhol circle.
And
was he established at that stage?
Oh, Bowie certainly was in terms of the UK. He was still trying to make a name for himself in America. But Bowie, because he was incredibly clever and incredibly on it and just to an extent, right place, right time, merchant of a sort of guy. Bowie, I think, was already a fan of the Stooges and was aware of Iggy Pop. So Bowie basically orchestrates the reassembly of the Stooges, this time with a guitar player called James Williamson. And they go to London and record their third album, this time billed as Iggy and the Stooges, which I guess tells its own tale in a way. They'd already sort of, I think, come under the umbrella of Bowie's manager, Tony DeFreeze, and he had this kind of almost Warholian little empire going on of kind of freaks and weirdos and the occasional band and artist as well, Bowie being one of them, Lou Reed being another. And Iggy Pop was brought in under that particular umbrella as well. So he, creatively, he's in a pretty kind of strong place. He's in a good place. He's got a collaborator in Bowie as a producer. Raw Power is a very different album to the first two albums. As its name suggests, it's a much rawer affair. The sound on it is almost ugly. It's when you first hear it, you kind of go, what is that? It's trebly and it's kind of shrieky and it sort of doesn't make any sense. It's quite a chaotic record. But in a weird kind of way, it's quite a focused one. And it's a brilliant, brilliant record. And I think of maybe of the three of them, particularly as it came along in that early part of the 1970s, when it was shoulder to shoulder with glam rock, what Bowie was doing, what people like Mark Bolan were doing. I think it kind of was ushered in alongside all that. It isn't necessarily really part of that, but it coincides with it. And of course, all that stuff, or much of it, was so important to the early punks. You know, those bands and artists were sort of spared the punk year zero sort of scorched earth thing that happened in 1976. They had a lot of regard for an album like Raw Power, hence the godfather of punk thing, you know. But yeah, without Bowie, it probably wouldn't have happened. Who knows where Iggy might have been if he hadn't have faithfully hooked up with Bowie at that point.
I know one of the tracks you've picked is China Girl.
Yes.
And this is, we know it from David Bowie singing it, but this is Iggy Pop singing it. And they wrote this together. This is long, long time before Bowie had the hit with it.
Yeah, absolutely. So this comes from Iggy's first solo album, The Idiots. And basically, Raw Power didn't sell that terribly well, inevitably. The band collapsed yet again, and Iggy finds himself really on the skids and basically kind of down and out and living on the streets, and eventually spends a spell in a mental health institute basically to try and kick his drug habit. Bowie stays in touch, to his credit, stands by him. One of the few people, it is said, who visited Iggy in that particular institution he was in, keeps him afloat financially and weans him away from Los Angeles. And Bowie himself at that time was basically trying to get away from LA too and all the temptations and habits that he'd got himself into there. So they both end up recording in France and Berlin, living in Berlin, and making the album The Idiot. And The Idiot is a very, very, very different beast to the Stooges and Iggy's work up to that point. It's almost like Bowie was using Iggy as a sort of a notebook for some of the ideas that he was kind of kicking around that he would then pursue on albums like Low and Heroes in his so-called Berlin period.
Would you call it a collaborative relationship or a beast, a power? Was there a power dynamic going on there?
I think the power was very much with David, but I think he saw in Iggy a guy who couldn't quite do certain things or could do certain things that David couldn't do. Iggy saw in Bowie a guy who was much more musically complete than perhaps Iggy was. So the two come together, they balance out, I think. But Iggy, I think, has admitted over the years that occasionally he sort of fell out of love with the records in terms of where he was personally at that time. He recognises them as great work, but I think sometimes he recalls that as maybe not entirely happiest time in his life. However, you know, they still stand as amazing records. The Idiot influenced everybody from Joy Division to Depeche Mode to Susie and the Banshees. Like, there's a list of bands and artists as long as your arm to this day who would point to The Idiot as possibly the first post-punk record, and it certainly influenced guys like Trent Reznor and Nine Inch Nails and all that sort of stuff.
Okay, let's listen to China Girl. So that's Iggy Pop there singing China Girl. Did they jointly write that?
Yeah, it's a co-write. And very fortunately, well, not fortunately, but, you know, he was lucky in that Bowie. Again, he's so up and down throughout certainly the first half of his life. And he's kind of in a bit of a low point again. And Bowie becomes this I mean, he was already a big star, but he becomes a megastar in 1983 with the Let's Dance album, and includes a version of that on it, which is an absolute lifeline to Iggy because, you know, he gets the writing royalties because they are co-writes. And Bowie repeats the trick. He continues to record several of the old Iggy Bowie collaborations in the 80s. So he really gifts Iggy a certain bit of financial security, possibly for the first time in his life.
Paul, you've talked there about his inconsistencies, and yet he's genius.
Yeah.
But the performance element.
Yes.
The wonderful performance element in one stage, and then how outrageous it got.
Absolutely. I mean, it's compelling, it's amazing, but I would have loved to have been there. For instance, there's a very famous bit of footage of Iggy and a fantastic rock and roll photograph, actually. It's one of the greatest rock and roll photographs of all time, if people want to Google it. He's walking on the crowd.
I was looking at it today. Yeah, it's amazing.
So they're holding him up, and he's not crowd surfing. He's walking on them like Jesus on the water. And he's wearing these elbow-length silver gloves, and he's actually smearing himself in peanut butter. This is an Iggy Pop live show from, you know, I think it may be early 70s, still the Stooges. And it's just amazing and compelling and kind of a bit dangerous, you know. And I've seen him, as I was saying at the top, you know, I've seen him live a few times. And even, you know, in the later part of his career, later part of his life, he still had that air of danger. There's an old Stooges song called Gimme Danger. And Iggy was still giving people danger anytime I saw him. So it'll be interesting to see if he's still as dangerous.
Now, he now is touring,
yeah,
and he has his own radio show.
Yeah, it's brilliant as well, yeah.
Yeah, tell us, what does he do in the radio show?
Well, he's great because he stays so current, you know, and I try to do the same myself. You know, it's hard to do. It's hard to do when you're doing other things, you know, and he's really managed to do it. He really has a good nose and a good ear for music, and particularly Irish, young Irish bands that he's given a bit of exposure to, like Fontaines D.C. and Meryl Streak more recently as well. So it's great. He mixes that with old anecdotes and old, it's kind of educational. He plays an old blues track. It's very eclectic. There's no kind of set musical agenda. It's a much praised show, and rightly so. And hopefully he'll continue to do it. And what a radio voice.
And you, yeah, what a radio voice.
I mean, I wish I talked like that.
And hasn't he, the in terms of the stage presence, do you think he's still got it? You saw him pretty recently, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's getting on a bit now. Everything's sort of, time seems to be accelerating. It was a show in the Albert Hall in London, but it was just magnificent. He did an album with Josh Homme from Queens of the Stone Age, which kind of harks back really to his Berlin sort of period. I think he'd kind of made his peace with that whole time and wanted to kind of revisit it, maybe in the wake of David Bowie's death, who knows. But it's very much an album that's of a piece with that period. And Josh Homme put a great band together, including Matt Helders of Arctic Monkeys on drums. Anyway, they did this show in the Albert Hall and I was down the front for it. And it was just astonishing. I mean, it was incredible. The energy was unbelievable.
Well, you have whetted our appetite, Paul McLoon. Thank you so much.
You're very
welcome. Hip Hop will play in the Meadows 2025 at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham on Saturday, June the 7th. Let's leave you with Lust for Life playing in the background. My thanks to Paul McLoon, and as I said, Iggy Pop will play the Meadows at the Royal Hospital Kilmainham on Saturday, June the 7th. Tickets are on sale at ticketmaster.ie. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound tonight. Researchers were Paula Shields and Leah Murphy, and Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tonight's show was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next after the news.